Welcome to the PR Moment podcast. Produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
This week on the PR Moment podcast, I'm interviewing Brendan Craigie, co-founder and managing partner of Taito. Now, Brendan joined Hotwire as an exec 3 months after it was founded and went on to become its group CEO. During his time at Hotwire, the firm grew from a turnover of presumably not a lot to a $31 million multi-geography firm. So the nature of the business completely changed. Now, unexpectedly for most observers, Brendan left Hotwire in 2017 before setting up Taito in October of that year. Nearly 18 months later, Taito has a fee income of approximately £1 million, so they are going some. Now, one plug for me this week before I crack on to welcome Brendan to the show. It's our annual PR Analytics Conference coming up on the 28th of Feb. All the details on the PR Moment homepage. And as ever, in my non-biased opinion, it's an outstanding speaker lineup. Brendan, welcome to the PR Moment podcast.
Great to be here, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Now, Brendan, I normally try and start these shows off on a smooth, easy question, potentially starting off at the start of your career in nice chronological order. But I reckon if we did that today, there'd be a lot of people out there shouting at their computers or their phones saying, come on, how come Brendan left Hotwire? So let's deal with that straight away, shall we? You were global CEO at Hotwire, and quickly after the firm merged with Eastwick in the US, you left. What's your solid story as to why that happened? Because from the outside looking in, the timing seemed a bit odd.
Yeah, no, I can appreciate that. I think, I've been with the company for 17 years and I'd been in the States for coming out to a couple of years.
So you're living out there?
Yeah, I was living in Manhattan, which was really cool. If you were to wind back a bit further, you know, prior to going to the States, I'd been in the CEO role for 3 or 4 years, been through a couple rebrands and repositionings of the agency, feeling fairly, very comfortable in the role, but, searching for a new challenge. You know, I think when we talk about careers, there's obviously the professional side of it, but then there's sort of like the human side of it and, wanting to be, and I'm just one of those people that constantly likes to challenge myself. Okay. And so I think, prior to going to the States, I was searching for a new challenge and sort of managed to, it sort of lined up with the company's desire to expand in the States for me to go over there. And part of that brief was to find a company to acquire to expand Hotwire's presence in the US and sort of really build out that global offering for the company. So that excited me. But it was sort of coming at a point when, I had been looking around and thinking about what next. So having then made that move to the States and sort of seen that through in terms of finding a great agency to become part of Hotwire, and it was an acquisition as opposed to a merger. It also sort of that all then came at a time in my personal life when I was about to turn 40, and been at the company for 17 years, turning 40, someone who just constantly needs to give myself a new challenge, and it just sort of almost felt like I'd reached a very logical endpoint in my Hotwire career, in the sense that, there didn't seem to be immediate opportunities to go and acquire lots more companies and sort of continue that trajectory. So I got really had the sense that it was going to be a case of pretty steady as she goes, and I've been doing that for 6 years. And I really had that sense of it was either now or never. I think I was
17 years was long enough.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a brilliant career. It was an incredible privilege.
We'll come on to it later. You'd been there 17 years, and I always have that conversation about whether people stick or twist to get that senior job that we all want in the end. Yeah. And you stuck, and my goodness, it worked out.
Yeah,
right?
I had the 17 year itch to do well, something different.
17 year itch combined with a midlife crisis.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just getting bored.
Right.
And I think that might
but
seem really odd.
But
you know?
Presumably at other times in your career at Hotwire, and I'll let you off the hook, you got bored.
Yes.
But on this occasion, and found a new challenge, or have been given a new challenge, but on this occasion, you made the decision to go, which is, I mean, I think 17 years is plenty at one firm.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, probably in the short term financially, not a very good decision, because anyone knows starting a new company, it's tough when you're getting things going.
Yeah.
But I've always sort of lived by that philosophy of you only live once. I joined Hotwire 3 months after it started, so technically I wasn't a founder. So I was, you know, part of the company. And so,
did you ever have equity?
I had sort of share options in the company, but I always probably had that like nagging question behind me, which is that, can you do it? You know, can you do it by yourself, like from scratch?
You'd watched other people do it.
Yeah, and so, and again, I just thought it's now or never.
Okay. Fine. So now we've got that over with. Let's go back to the very start, which you hinted at there. You were at Hotwire for, as we say, 17 years. But before that, your first ever job was at Weber Shandwick. And that had a massive impact of the rest of your career in terms of who you worked for at Weber. Just talk us through that.
Well, I mean, so
have I got that wrong?
No, you've got it right. But there's some nuances to it, which is that I was studying politics in Leeds. Desperately trying to get
to each other, because I was up at Hull.
Ah, right, okay.
And we're the same age, so we were separated by about 30 miles.
I'm sure we might have crossed paths in some dodgy nightclub. So I was sort of searching for my first foot in the door to get into PR. And, at university, I wrote for the student newspaper, organise events, so I sort of knew that was the career for me.
Get involved with all the various
little
bits
bit,
and pieces.
A little bit. You know, I was sort of like, had that thing about wanting to try and, you know, get into debate, change opinions, that type of thing.
Okay.
And got a job working for what was Shandwick in Leeds, working on a very like a quirky range of clients. One of my clients in that short stint was like involved in staging a concert at the Royal Albert Hall, which was quite something. And then sort of 6 months into that, I realised I wanted to move to London. And I went down to, Shandwick with the blessing of my boss and had the opportunity.
It was called Shandwick at that point.
It was Shandwick, and then had the opportunity to interview at different parts of Shandwick with the corporate, public affairs. And I decided I wanted to go into the tech. And I got interviewed by Kristin Siltovic, who was the founder, who eventually left to create Hotwire.
Funny how these things work.
Yeah. So I had a really exciting year there. I was involved working with Microsoft as they were sort of making a real push into the mobile space at the time. Super exciting. But as that campaign took off,
that went well.
Well, at the time it was going well, and then as the account grew, the account team grew, and as I was getting more and more sort of capable, the layers of management were getting thicker on that account.
It's interesting
I was literally like account executive pushing senior account executive, and probably in the autumn of that year. Kristin left to set up Hotwire, and then and then pretty much at the turn of that year, I sort of reached out to them and said, look, I'm really interested in what you're doing.
Okay. So you reached out to them rather than vice versa.
They'd already recruited a number of people.
Right.
And so I ended up joining initially as a freelancer for 3 months because they were sensitive to issues around, you know.
Yeah.
I joined as a senior account executive, and I was also the head of the telecoms practice because there was no one else who in the telecoms practice. So I just reported directly to the MD, Kristin. And that was just a really exciting opportunity for me, and sort of then you just had lots of different opportunities through the years.
And then you clearly got promoted whilst you were at Hotwire quite a bit. Can we just deal with the first stage, so before Kristin left?
Yeah.
When did they leave? About 2012?
I think it was 2011.
2011, okay. So you started off low.
I started as a senior account executive. Right, that would have been in, January 2001.
And when were you first sort of an MD-type role? Because that seemed to happen.
It was before
Kristin left, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it would have been around 2006, 2000. It was prior to the company being acquired, which was in 2007. So yeah, within probably actually like 6 or 7 years, I've become MD of the UK
which is
business.
I mean, that's surprising, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know whether that says more about Hotwire or you, or maybe a bit of both.
I don't know.
But it was that was a remarkable progression.
It really was. It was very challenging. But that's kind of what I thrive on. I thrive on being out of my comfort zone and, like the pressure.
Okay. So let's just go there then, shall we? Because it just becomes a bit too egotistical about this conversation. But there are plenty of account execs, account directors, associate directors, etc., who would quite like to become MD of the firm.
Yeah.
I can't think of too many who are made MD of the firm at as tender age that you were at that time. What do you think they saw in you to promote you so quickly?
Gosh, I think it's a really tough one, that, isn't it? I mean, I think you have to deliver results.
Okay,
you know, I think ultimately you're in our, in probably in any business, but in our industry, you're measured on results.
So what results you in terms of client
like,
work?
You know,
and
doing client
business?
Work, client work, you know, growing your practice areas.
Okay,
and then I think it's about getting the best out of the people that you work with. You know, so being able to lead a team of people when you get to that level, and that was something which I really enjoy. You know, I get a lot of, I guess personally. To be motivated, I need to be challenged. Okay. You know, like I really need to be challenged. And I'm you can do that for yourself, can't you? You know, when you're running a company. But then, in my role, I was fortunate to get very challenged by the founders of Hotwire. But then, as a consequence of me feeling that that's really important, it's something that I bring to my relationship with people that I work with. So I sort of like I really, you know. Try and create opportunities for people to be challenged, to grow, to develop. Because I sort of think if that's what I like, then you know most people also appreciate that.
But how does
that
manifest itself in reality?
I think it manifests itself in terms of you know, being observing what people are really good at.
No, but what opportunities are you giving people?
Well, I guess you know.
Or do they give you? I
think what you. I think it's about. One of my expressions that I was sort of very, very sort of fond of is growth creates opportunity.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that would sort of almost, that's an incentive for everyone working within a business. So, you know, if you run a division or a practice, if that practice sort of grows, then you know, you need to create structures that allow for that growth, which creates new challenges, new opportunities, and all of the rewards that come with that in terms of better salaries, bonuses, and so on. So I think by basically going on, having this sort of focus on growth, you sort of create opportunities for people to take on more responsibilities.
Okay. But growth is crucial.
Yeah, growth. I think growth is crucial. I mean, I think
I would agree.
Anyone who's looking to progress in their career. The probably, you know, joining a business which is growing is a good starting point.
Yeah, because you've got opportunities and financially business can afford to do things.
Yeah.
If businesses aren't growing, then they are limited by the decisions they can make.
Yeah, but
also if you're from your perspective, a business is growing, it's actually much easier to manage, isn't it?
Yeah.
It might be, it's harder to get the business to grow, but it's a much easier thing to grow, to manage a business that's growing than one that is.
And you can experiment. You don't have to sort of ration things quite as well.
Yeah, good point.
So I like working, I like working in those growing environments, and I think it becomes a very a cultural attribute of the company because if the problem comes, of course, when you stop growing. Yeah, and I think that's the problem when you get to a substantial size.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the growth sort of tends to tail off, and then again, that becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy because you aren't able to offer the same opportunities to people, and therefore people go and get them elsewhere. You know, so
and
I think
people go and set their own PR firms.
Exactly, so people set their own PR agencies up. So
So the just looking at Hotwire, just for sort of final question on that. Really, you were there, as I say, for 17 years. one of the most, we touched on it, but a remarkable success tale personally for yourself was that you made yourself, you went from an account exec or whatever up to global CEO in the end. You must have had some offers during that time. So how come you decided not to twist?
I mean, I sort of had lots of thoughts over the years. So one side thought was, because I sort of had this inkling to want to own my own business, and running someone else's business is not the same as owning your own business.
No.
I was toying with the idea of going into coffee. I went to like trade shows, and I was thinking of going, setting up a business.
When we say get into coffee, what are we talking about?
I was sort of thinking about a mail order.
Okay.
You know, yeah.
Nespresso type.
More like sort of probably a high end, you know, roasted, you know, but, you know, artisan roasted, but I basically realized that I'd have to sell a lot of coffee to make a lot of money. Right. And then I toyed with the idea
as probably is Mr. Amazon, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the difference with all that stuff.
This is sort of like, and then, you know, I sort of thought about in-house opportunities, and, you know, there were probably points where I went and spoke to other agencies, but what those exercises were good at is showing me that the grass wasn't greener, you know, and actually I had great opportunities where I was. And I was just very fortunate that whenever I had these sort of moments of doubt where I was thinking about doing something different, I would get sat down. It was almost like there was some mind reading going on. I'd get sat down by, you know, Kristen and the, you know, other founder of Hotwire, Anthony, and they'd be like, Brendan, you know, we'd like to talk to you about this and other new challenge for you, okay. You know? And so there was like a conveyor belt of challenges.
So it sort of sounds to me like you had those senior mentors up until about 2011.
11, yeah.
And then after that, you missed that.
Yeah, I think I missed it. But also I was sort of in a bit of a halfway house in that you're reporting into a holding company with fairly sort of straightforward requirements, you know, that you deliver certain
KPIs.
Results, you know, that it's not particular, you're not really
margin in revenue.
Yeah. It's very driven by those kind of things. So that the canvas on which you've got to operate an experiment is kind of limited, you know,
right.
So
you could go and play somewhere. And you might, and that all might go very well or not. But actually, as long as you delivered,
that was the main focus,
which was a good thing and a bad thing.
Yeah, it's a good thing, but also it can be you know, it's brilliant in some ways, but I think it doesn't really create, sort of give you the canvas to completely reimagine something or take a really big risk. You know, right. I think to grow businesses, you need to be very entrepreneurial. Speculative, you know, but to deliver the kind of results that, say, a holding company requires, you need to be a brilliant manager. You know, like you need to be a relatively safe pair of hands. You might on the surface have to have some jazz hands and make it all sound really exciting, but ultimately, what they're after is consistent performance.
Yeah,
I've shown that I can do both of those things, but actually what excites me is the greenfield opportunity of building something.
It's really interesting, because if you'd have asked me, and we used to know each other in your Hotwire days, I would have said you were absolutely the former. So a proper business manager who had a track record of growth and organisation and could manage that business.
Yeah.
But we'll come on to it in a minute. What you've shown with Taito is, you've got that entrepreneurial bit as well.
Yeah.
Good point. So I just to push a bit on that, when Kristen and Anthony left Hotwire in 2011, did you feel more, you must have felt more isolated. Did you feel empowered or not really?
I think it was, it's an interesting one because on one hand, let me try to think in terms of that. It's like, on one hand, there is sort of a great sense of freedom to do new things, But in a way, it takes you, it took me a couple of years to have the complete confidence to assert myself.
Which I think is fair enough.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
so
it's a
I
big
think,
firm by then.
Yeah.
And it's your first role within that type of that type of role, I should say.
Yeah.
First time in that type of role.
That's, you know. So I think, you know, actually probably, Hotwire's just recently gone through a rebrand, but, you know, but we've took the business through a rebrand sort of, God knows, you know, going back four or five years. But that was the first opportunity for me to like sort of put my mark on things. But I'd say it did take a couple of years to like fully appreciate the freedom that you had. Yeah.
Most of these PR agency rebrands are pretty subtle rebrands.
Yeah.
But, right. Now, you left Hotwire in... Actually, I just want to ask you one more thing about that time. How many acquisitions did you do? You obviously did the Eastwick acquisition. I'm not suggesting you led
that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I did.
On your own.
Oh, no, but with the support of the parent company, yeah.
So just give us a few... having been part of the buy side on that, I guess it's quite useful now as you're building Tyto up. A bit of advice in terms of people who are looking to build and structure their agency with a view on a sale, albeit there's fewer buyers in town.
Yeah. So you're talking about people selling their business.
Yeah.
Well, I think probably.
So you're a mole.
Yeah. Well, I think financial performance is important, and you know, having professionally managed accounts that you can sort of demonstrate.
Are you 3 years growth? Is it as simple as that? Is that kind of the? Or is it a bit more than that these days?
I don't think there's one type of buyer. So I think really, if you're talking about what you're trying to demonstrate, it probably slightly depends on who you're trying to sell to.
Okay.
But generally speaking, financial performance, reputation, you know, like having sort of a very strong profile in your industry,
right.
Quality of your client base.
Right.
And probably, you know.
And longevity of client base. As
yeah,
well,
longevity, quality of management team. I think something that people are always sort of nervous about is how much is sort of tied up with the founder.
Yeah.
So those are probably just some of the things.
Okay. Now, when you left Hotwire in 2017, did you have a tear in your eyes as you walked out the door for the last time?
Absolutely. Yeah. I prepared like a little speech and gave a little speech to my management team. So there's, you know, like there were people all around the business, you know, from across the globe together. And yeah, no, it was. I definitely shed some tears, and then
did you get through your speech without blubbing?
I think I did. Yeah, I think I didn't do bad. I got like a round of applause and everything. but the funny thing is, I think possibly this is like my subconscious talking. Whenever I always used to get slightly jealous of people when they did their leaving speeches. So you know, you can imagine over 17 years,
you'd seen
a lot of people do leaving speeches, and I'd be always like. God, you're going to do something new, you know?
Yeah.
And so actually, when I actually came to my time to do it, that was there was an element of pleasure to that. But then I think it was almost a bit like a divorce.
Okay.
You know, because you...
Didn't think you were going to say that.
Well, but... you know, as in you've having being... involved in this business for 17 years.
Yeah.
You know, that's very entwined with your identity and everything that you've done for a really long time.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, I'd probably for a few months afterwards, you know, I had to go through a process of like decoupling and detaching.
Because you'd think, oh, what about that? I don't have to care about that anymore.
Yeah, or you'd be thinking, oh, I wonder how so-and-so's getting on, or
right.
I wonder how
okay.
that's happening.
Yeah.
And so... all the things you would ordinarily have thought about, you didn't have to think about. And so there was like a bit of a, there was a real void in my life.
Right.
And when I originally left, there was this, I had this idea of, I'm going to take a year out and, you know, just chill, relax and think about things. But within a few months of doing that, I was getting really stressed about not having something to do, you know, And so I didn't need to. I didn't need to start my new company.
Take up golf or something.
I ended up then just starting thinking about the new business and what I was going to do.
Okay.
And so I ended up bringing the launch forward by a few months, just because I just needed to do something.
Okay. That's worrying. That is.
It is. Yeah. I'm definitely.
I hope that doesn't happen to me. So go on, tell me about Taito, which you've co-founded with Ellen Raphael.
Okay. Well, so I guess we're pan-European agency focused on the colliding worlds of science, technology, and innovation. So you've
said that before, haven't you, Brendan?
Have I? Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we deliberately wanted to frame the company broader than just pure technology.
Okay.
And then
what did you say? The colliding worlds of technology.
Science, technology, and innovation.
Nice.
And then we are very focused on helping clients solve business challenges through the power of communication. So just, you know, a lot of people will knock on your door and say, I need some PR. But, you know, what we really try to do is get beneath the surface to understand, you know, what it is that what's the challenge that people as someone is grappling with.
Yeah, but everyone says that.
Yeah, well,
So what does that mean? I know what you're trying to do is a bit different.
Yeah.
So just talk us through why it's different beyond that.
Yeah,
that corporate speak, if you like.
Yeah, which, sure. Well, I mean, I just think it's. I think we've just got a very senior team of people,
right?
And I guess I've been the CEO of a 250-person company with a reasonable turnover. No giant company by any sense of imagination, but a lot of tech companies would be much smaller than that.
Yeah.
So I'm someone that understands what it's like to grow a business, but also I'm like, I love PR. And so I sort of just bringing that sort of commercial perspective and that PR perspective to challenges, I think, informs our outlook. And then we have this operator model, which we call PR Without Borders, which has two elements to it. One, we have a team of people that work across UK, Netherlands, Spain, Germany, and France, and we work as one. So I sort of wanted to challenge the idea of having silos, so having a French team, a German team, and actually, so we've got a multilingual team that worked together as one across borders.
Right.
So,
Do you used to live in Valencia?
I've got a house in Valencia and a place in London.
It's a nice touch, isn't it?
So then that ties up to another thing, which is that having worked in tech, and just one of the things that really interested me was just a lot of the tech businesses have this location agnostic model where they don't mind where people work, where they're based. And so I felt that in our industry, one of the biggest restrictions on growing a successful business and giving clients the best talent was the fact that everyone had to go and turn up to an office in Shoreditch or, you know, an office in Soho. And so we basically allow our teams to work from wherever they want to work. You know, so we've got a lot of people that probably hit that stage in their life where they want to get a bigger house, want to get the children into good schools. They love what they do, but they don't want to work for a regional agency. But equally, they want to be able to balance their work and life. And so we've got a very senior team of people that work in this remote way.
Just talk me through that, because I that makes perfect sense, of course. But in an agency environment, you know, they are in the end, without sounding too cliche, the people business, and you need to be able to bounce ideas around, and there's a certain energy that you get when you have a bunch of people together, and you know, some of that's formal, some of that's informal, the friendships, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So that, and look, the world is going the way you've just described.
Yeah.
But it doesn't come without its challenges.
No.
And potentially without its drawbacks.
Yeah.
So just talk me through if those are overcomeable, whether you agree with that.
Well, I mean, no, I think we had this idea that this could work. But without testing it, we weren't completely confident. But what I can say is categorically it works. And the first point is we say we're location agnostic. So if someone wants to work from home, that's their primary office, that's cool. If they want to work in an office, we set people up in a co-working office. So we've got a real mix. We have learned that there are a lot of things that we did in an office that are replicable in a remote environment. So we have a Monday morning meeting, which we just do over video. We have Friday drinks, which you may laugh. You know, we do over video. You know, people have a drink and you sort of download on the week, and it's right. All quite lighthearted.
How long does the Friday drinks last?
You know,
Skype
it goes on a long time, actually, because people just like are chatting about the week, what they're doing at the weekend. It's just very people enjoy that.
Do you incorporate a sort of drinking game into that?
No drinking games. Right. There are some dogs that appear. But then it's important to realise that people aren't just sort of locked away in their home offices and they never come out.
Yeah.
You know, it's they're probably in London a couple of days a week to meet with clients, journalists or what have you. But they don't have to turn up to the office every single day. We use video for everything. We don't send any internal emails. Everything's over Slack. And then we have these things called Hack Weeks where we work together as one team in a European city two or three times a year. So we've been to Valencia. We're going to Lisbon in July for a week. So we'll set up camp in a city and work together for a week, and we'll do training and that type of stuff. But the big learning that summarizes it all up is that what we've learned is that when everyone is remote, no one feels remote. You know, so you do get that same energy. Everyone's really invested in making it work. People maybe don't see each other for a week in person, but then they meet them and say, God, it feels like you don't have any sense that you've not seen that person because you've been on video with them all the time. It's really good.
The obvious drawback is one about more junior people, isn't it?
Yeah,
because if you're new to a career,
yes,
what you can't really do is work from home.
Yeah.
But I know you've placed emphasis on
more senior
people.
Yeah.
So is that going to become a problem as you grow the business and increase the breadth of seniority?
I think it's we anticipate having a much flatter structure, you know, so less. We've got like three levels: consultant, senior consultant, and sort of head of practice. So we envisage having less hierarchy, and you know, really trying to cultivate a team of practitioners that don't want to necessarily be managers. So they might be more senior, but they're really quite hands on. Because I think, there are people out there. Not everyone wants to become a manager, you know. And I think that's what they're the type of people we're trying to appeal to.
Everyone wants to become a manager until they become a manager.
And then it's like, no. Think, oh, no. But we do have, you know, junior people that work for us, but they're people that...
Yeah, but
actually,
they're fine junior. They can't
not
work
brand,
from
not brand new exactly. out of university, no.
So 2 years, 3 years,
two
four
or three
years?
Three years.
Because that's always the bit that's an issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
It happens in my
absolutely.
Business as well. It's not just a PR thing or a title thing.
It's an issue. And I think I very openly say that probably only 1 out of 10 people are right for Taito. You know, like in terms of the general, you know, of the people that might work into another agency in London, I would say only 1 in 10 of them are right for Taito. And that's because they've got to, the model that we've got has to appeal to them. It has to have a relevance to them. You know, like if they live in central London, they love living in central London, they could work in any other agency, then great. Why would you want to work for Taito? Okay. But we're trying to appeal to the 1 in 10 person. And
But you have a London office, right?
We've got offices here, but I guess...
I get what you're saying.
So, our time, our sort of classic employee is someone who, you know, we've got someone who worked in London, got a great career, was in a long-term relationship with someone in the Midlands, decided they wanted to live together, started working for a regional agency there, found it a bit slow.
Yeah.
They now work for us. You know, so we've got someone
that... By that time, they'd bought a dog, so they couldn't...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, so I think we're trying to appeal for people that see the quality of life benefits that we're going to bring and, you know, want to be part of something that's really exciting, really dynamic, but but want that flexibility.
But what you're not trying to... There must be a bit of the type of work you're doing that is relevant to this structure, isn't there? Because what you're not trying to do is build a press office for
people. Yeah, well, I think actually... So when we talk about PR Without Borders, we've talked a little bit about the geographic aspect of that and the pan-European focus. But the other part of it is just recognizing that the lines between marketing and PR are blurred, you know. So we do a whole host of different things. So whether it's, you know, videos, podcasts, you know, your traditional PR, social research. But basically, we don't have a predetermined way of solving a client's communications challenge. You know, so we think about what is the business challenge, and then we think about what's the communications solution to that, and that may or may not be media relations. And so we have this. Whereas I'd say most account agencies structure their accounts in sort of like a pyramid model, ours are structured around a round table model, and we then say, look at that round table and think, what does this particular client need? And then we put the individuals around that table based upon what are the services, the requirements that are needed to deliver on that campaign.
But don't most firms do that? I mean, that's not... I think, don't get me wrong, but we'll come on to what is clearly working really well for you.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would suggest that is not a revolution in client thinking.
Yeah.
It's got to be done well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you've got to have the right people with the right expertise doing the right stuff. But what you've just described is not a eureka moment.
No. Well, I think what I've observed, and I think this is something that came through from the research I did before we created the company, is that there's a sense that often there are lots of silos within agencies, you know. Okay. So when those capabilities exist, often they are in different pockets. You know, they're in different divisions headed by different people.
You mean like a research team, a digital team?
Correct.
Video production team?
Yeah. And often the client is not – the client's requirements are not treated with – the priority that they should do. And instead, what you end up with internal discussions about, should we bring that team in? Because if we do, then we're going to have to give them some of the revenue. Yeah. And so you end up with these sort of like internal turf battles that go on between different divisions, whereas we just don't have that, you know. So we have this very borderless way of thinking. Okay. Set
so
of skill
borderless
set.
For you, in a way, it sort of confuses me a little bit when you talk about borderless, because I start thinking about countries.
Yeah, sure.
But that's not really how you mean it.
I think we both mean it geographically, but also in terms of how we think about communications challenges and what the answer to them are.
Okay, fine. Now, one thing that impressed me when we did the pre-show chat was your fee income. You launched in what, just under 18 months old?
Yeah.
Toto, right? And your fee income is over £1 million, which is fantastic.
I mean, yeah, yeah.
You know, all credit to you. Because that's, there's a danger. I've used this line before, so apologies to regular listeners, but we think of these things in monopoly money. It's only £1 million. £1 million's a lot of money.
It's a lot of
money. It's a lot of stuff to win.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Inside it, especially within a year.
Yeah, yeah.
Or just over, to be fair.
Yeah.
Of launching a business. So that's fantastic. So that's really impressive. The other thing that's really interesting is I know there's a bit of project in there as well, but basically it's around sort of 10 or so clients.
Yeah.
So your average revenue per client is very
high, yeah.
Especially when you're a startup.
Yeah.
So that's presumably that is a part of the plan, is it?
Well,
that
doesn't
happen by accident.
I think, no, totally it has, it's obviously desirable, but it was not how we anticipated it.
Okay.
You know, I mean, credit to my team because we've got an incredible team. So, and I think they deserve the credit. And we are very, very fortunate to have a brilliant portfolio of clients. But I think potentially how we've arrived at this point is that we got a lot of interest and we got invited to all these pitches. And we quickly realized that as the new kid on the block, often you're just put in there as the wild card. And so for the majority of last year, we made the strategic decision not to do competitive pitches. So we basically would wait until we met people that were like-minded, that really bought into our model, really bought into what we wanted. And we worked in a very sort of consultative way to develop the right communication solutions for them. As a consequence, they end up with a great plan for how to address it. And often, as a consequence, we end up taking on briefs which are much broader than just doing media relations. So I think one of the reasons why we've ended up this situation is just it's about how we engage with potential clients and what opportunities we go after. And I would say probably if there's any lesson for anyone starting a new company, it's that the clients that you work with will, in that sort of first 12 to 18 months, will, you know, really shape what your business is going to be like. Mm. And so, you know, we've now built, this is who Taito is. You know, like, it wasn't necessarily what Taito was going to be okay. when we first started, but Taito now is, you know, working with clients that have quite a broad communications need. And we've evolved into that. But it, and so, but, and
so
that's.
So you're saying that the sort of work you're doing is, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's the business level problems as opposed to the product level problems.
I think that's a good way of talking about it. It's sort of just really helping companies that have a very clear commercial focus about what they're trying to do and helping them look at their communications in a very broad sense, not just in a very narrow, okay. like, what's our press coverage? And then again, that's in turn about who we're engaging with in our clients. We have, you know, very sort of senior level relationships with the people that we're working with. So I think I was listening to this podcast with the founder of Airbnb when I was sort of building up to launch Taito, and they talk about how they really, in the sort of first year or two in a startup, it's sort of like the crafting stage where you're really just trying to find out who your customer is. You're trying to find out define what your product is.
Yeah.
And then once you do that, then you're in a better position to market to other people. And I think that's what we've been doing.
Yeah.
And I think we've sort of got quite a good sense of who we are now.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. A lot of businesses did that. PR Moment did that.
Did they? Yeah.
So I won't bore you with why. But yeah. You launch with the... with the, what you think is a fine plan,
yeah.
and then you quickly go, actually, it's not quite working, so
yeah.
you evolve it, and you find your place. And just finally, last question from me: what's the name all about?
So, you know, so I used to have this thing of like collecting domain names and thinking about
I
a
still
new
have
company.
That.
Do you?
But
yeah.
the problem is that the expense
adds up,
right?
All the good ones have gone. Yeah, no, it's
so
true.
Think, I'll keep that one for a rainy day, and then you suddenly realise you spent £500.
And it's quite a fun yeah. So I've bought all these domains, but whenever I had a quiet moments, I'd be thinking about potential names, and I knew that I wanted to. I like to think I'm quite a thoughtful person, and so you know I wanted our agency brand to convey that, and so you start going off in all different directions thinking about things that convey thoughtfulness and. I thought about what about animals and who do people, you know, people think owls are really wise. And so then I was sort of doing some research around owls, and there is a family of owls, which includes the barn owl, which is called, which the family is called Taito. And so that's where the name came from. But, you know, I really like it because then it gives you a brand an identity because you know, owls look at problems from above. They can turn their head by 280 degrees. They can see in the dark.
Nice.
And then that then feeds into how we, you know, present our brand as well.
I definitely don't think barn PR would have worked.
No. Or, yeah, owl PR or you know, when I you won't see any owls on the website, you know, so it's quite a nice backstory.
I'll keep my eyes peeled.
Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Thanks for listening to the PR Moment podcast, produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
If you'd enjoyed the show, please do review us on iTunes and give us a decent rating.